This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with religious scholar Ursula King. She is Professor Emerita of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Bristol. I spoke with her on April 25th, 2012, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was in the studios of the BBC in Bristol, England. This interview is included in our show about Teilhard de Chardin. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org. Hello. Hello, Dr. King. It's so good to speak with you. Well, I've really loved delving into Teilhard and to you these last couple of days, and I got here a little bit late. I got stuck in bad traffic, so I'm just pulling out my books. But
Right. Take your time.
Okay. Do you have any questions for me before we start?
I had asked Nancy Rosenbaum what we were going to discuss, but I saw that in the initial invitation she had put that you wanted to ask me about the life, mm-hmm. ideas, and legacy of Teilhard de Chardin. So it depends very much where you want to put the main emphasis. I don't mind whichever topics come up. That's fine by me, I think. Yeah. I have done various interviews on Teilhard, and, you know, I have got covered quite a variety of topics in my book. So I'm happy to follow your lead if you want to, you know, if you have a sort of
yes.
priority of...
No, that's how I'd like to do it. I mean, that's what we will explore. And we'll explore it conversationally. I'm interested. Obviously, I'm speaking with you, and so I'm. You know, this is very much coming through your experience of Teilhard and these decades you've spent steeped in his legacy. So I'm not just interested in. We're not going to pretend like this is all objective, but I also want your take on this as a 21st century person. And I think the way, I have a lot of questions to go from, but I think the way we're focusing this is, we won't do an exhaustive breakdown of his thought and theology, but we'll focus it in terms of getting a handle on that, because assuming that a lot of listeners, you know, may never have heard of him or may have heard the name but don't really know,
right.
don't have full connotations. But then, you know, what in his thought... speaks to modern people, and I think there's still a lot more there than we can do in an hour, but that's the way we'll break it down.
Okay.
So I'm getting some messages from behind the glass. I'm hearing an echo. Is that what you're going to say? Okay, all right. I'm going to be quiet while the engineers take care of things.
I have no echo. I have no echo at this end. Not mm-hmm. what comes through to me.
Okay.
No, the volume is just fine. I hear well. My voice, I don't know how long it will last for an hour. I sip a little bit of water or tea in between.
Yeah, don't worry.
But it's the level of sound is just perfect for me.
I don't know
how mm-hmm. it comes through to you. Mm-hmm. Here it is fine.
You know what, Chris, I noticed when I turned my volume down, also the echo. Is it okay for you? Because I'm not hearing it now that I've turned my volume down. Okay. All right. Let's just... Good. Okay. Let's do this then.
Okay.
All right. Great. We're ready. I'd like to actually start just knowing a little bit more about you, the background you brought to this, not just academically, and I wonder, was there a spiritual background to your childhood, to the beginning of your life?
Not in a very specific way. I was born in Cologne, but I was born just before the beginning of the Second World War, and then mm-hmm. we were evacuated, and then I grew up in a very rural area in the mountains, and I was brought up really as a Catholic in this little village where we were evacuated. And it is really, you know, that's my beginning, and that's also influenced my schooling And then I had this very deep desire later on to study theology, which was very resisted. I knew nothing about Teya at that time. I wanted to study philosophy and religion.
Where did that deep desire come from?
I always read a lot. I was up to the age of 15 in a school of many of my teachers were nuns, but maybe it came from their influence. I don't know. But then from the age of 15 and a half, I was in Cologne in a big secular school, really largely with boys. We were only four girls in the class. The rest were boys, and we had a very secular curriculum. Mm-hmm. We had some, in Germany, you always have religious education as part of the curriculum, and we had a Dominican father who gave us once a week for an hour's religious lessons. I mean, religious lessons meaning education about religion rather than into religious practice. So it was more knowledge-oriented, and I got interested in reading about Thomas Aquinas and Philip. I had a very good philosophy teacher. I read a lot of philosophy. I worked on Newman. I did all sorts of things. And then I don't know. Through this, I got suddenly the idea I would really like to study these questions at university. That's how it started.
And how did you discover Teilhard?
Well, that's quite a wonderful story because I was a very keen student, and I also got a big national grant because I was a very poor student. I got a grant to study, and I was encouraged to study at least one semester, if not a year, abroad. And I chose to study in Paris. And I went to the Institut Catholique and the Sorbonne to do philosophy and theology. And I met many people who are internationally quite famous, whether Gabriel Marcel or Ricoeur or... Mm. Anyway, my theological lectures came from Jesuit professors, and one of the professors, who was actually a Belgian, he had known Teilhard de Chardin, and he had tried to publish some of his essays before Teilhard died, and Teilhard wasn't allowed to get things published. Then he, in 1962, when the Vatican issued a document saying that Teilhard de Chardin's ideas should not be taught in any Catholic seminary.
This was after his books had been published, his death.
No, it was after his death, but only two or three of his books were out. This was at the beginning, but he was very well known in France. He was very well known.
Okay.
And so this enterprising, audacious professor who also had a visiting professorship in California, used to go to California every year for one semester, he decided he would give a series of public lectures in Paris on Teilhard de Chardin. And that's how I discovered him. And it was a wonderful experience. And he lent me almost the very last essay that Teilhard wrote, which was then only in a cyclostyled form. It had not been published. It was not published till the late 1970s. But that essay is called The Heart of Matter. And that is really the spiritual autobiography of Teilhard, written in 1950. And that contains, in a nutshell, his inner development and how he really discovered this wonderful the development of the world, the evolution of the cosmos, and the way this really is intertwined with human development and spiritual development. And it's an absolutely wonderful text which has the motto, the heart of matter, a world heart, the heart of a God. So he sees really everything centered diffused, penetrated, enlivened, energized by the divine. That's why he speaks about the divine milieu. I mean, this is really a very, very rich notion for him. And it is this, I mean, he writes somewhere, throughout all of creation, that's to say, throughout all of the universe, without exception, everything the divine assails us through everything. You see, everything is somehow a connection to the divine if we but discover it or make it or whatever.
So I think this is also a passage from Heart of the Matter. which is one of the passages you isolated for when you selected some of his writings. And,
right.
And this also gets at the fact that that matter, and initially in the beginning of his life, you know, matter in its most solid form in terms of how we perceive it, rocks,
yes,
were captivated him. And he grew up, of course, in a mountainous region of France where there were extinct volcanoes. And so here...
That's in the Auvergne.
So here's some... I'm just going to read some of these lines that really struck me.
Right.
At the very beginning of my conscious life and my efforts to attain and grasp the solidity to which my innate demand for plenitude impelled me, I tried above all to capture the essence of matter by looking for it in its most closely defined and concentrated and heaviest forms. Then it was that my newly born attraction to the world of rocks began to produce the beginning of what was to be a permanent broadening of the foundations of my interior life. I'm just going to read another passage later on. He says, later, when I was studying geology, it might well have appeared that all I was doing was seriously and successfully to consider the chances of a career in science. In reality, however, during the whole of my life, there was but one thing which would irresistibly bring me back to the study of the great eruptive masses and continental shelves. That was an insatiable desire to maintain contact with a sort of universal root or matrix of beings. And he says the truth is that he's never been able to feel at home, even at the peak of his spiritual trajectory, unless immersed in an ocean of matter.
Right.
That's so, it's just so vivid and unusual. We don't hear people talk about rocks that way and climb to those spiritual peaks at the same time.
Yeah, he has got a palpably concrete sense of, you know, what matter is, the hard matter, the matter that is often seen in terms of brute forces, but that is from inwardly energized, centered, leads us to life. I mean, he collected first stones and rocks. Then he moved on to collecting crystals. And, you know, he was always looking for something concrete. And
metals, right? He was very fascinated with them.
Yes, metals, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to really see all this, how this, you know, how the whole world, the globe, is actually something very material. You know, whether you look at the rocks, the rivers, everything is there, the molten lava that comes out of a volcano. I mean, he grew up in a volcanic area in the Auvergne. So he had this sense, and his father was an amateur scientist who encouraged all his children to do fossil collections. That's how it really started. He was brought up in a very devout Catholic traditional family. He could have become just a traditional priest without all this, but because his father encouraged them to do this, he had this great curiosity, and he was always drawn to the outside. I mean, I keep thinking, I've been to the places where he was born and where he wrote in the Auvergne, and the very house he lived in. And, you know, you see this, it's still a very rural area. It's outside Clermont-Ferrand, outside the provincial city that is the capital of the Auvergne. And it is... you know, I think of my own children and grandchildren, children who are so full of curiosity, who want to climb the trees, jump into the river, swim, go up the mountain, you know, and they did this. And they were, I mean, he was in a family, he was the fourth child of 11 children. There was a very large family unit there. And then in the holidays, they would all meet up with their cousins. So it would be really like a crowd, almost like a little village, if you like. And they would go on picnics and go for walks. And he always had these kind of stirring questions and ideas. And he was drawn to something. It was quite mysterious. I mean, he had vocation for working matter, for discovering things. So he was drawn to geology. He became a geologist. He had doubts about it when he was first a young Jesuit, whether really you could do that. But he did it, and he really devoted his life to it and became an internationally known scientist. But he always had this very deep spiritual vision of things.
Right. And so he became a priest at a very young age, which would not have been all that unusual in that kind of devout Catholic family. And
well,
then
he was, sorry, he was only ordained in 1911 when he was 30. That's not so young anymore. But he joined the Jesuits at the age of...
Oh, he joined the Jesuits at 18, right.
Yeah, but
okay.
I mean, then you have over 10 years training.
Right. Okay. But he did join the order.
Yes, young.
As a young adult. And then it seems to me that the other cathartic experience that then continued to shape him was... So he became a Jesuit, and he became a scientist. And then, in 1914, he went into the trenches of World War I, where he worked as a stretcher bearer.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this phrase appearing in his writing and in your writing about him, that he discovered in that experience, alongside his sense of the milieu of nature of matter, he discovered this whole new human milieu. And I want you to talk to me about how you think that then shaped his vision, including how he then went back into his science and his theology.
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's before, just shortly before here, 2 or 3 years before he went to war, he discovered evolution when he was a student, towards the end of studying theology, which he studied in England. I mean, he studied it on an island. He studied it in Hastings, in south of England. And he had by then already been teaching in a Jesuit college in Cairo. So he had already been subject to influences which were outside Europe. You know, he had this sense of the world being really very large. But he, when he went to war, he didn't want, I mean, he had the right, and he should have really been an officer, and he didn't want to be an officer. He wanted to be with the ordinary man. He wanted to be just an ordinary soldier. So because he was a priest, he couldn't fight and be a combatant, so he became a stretcher bearer. And he was particularly keen, and I don't know how far this really involved a personal choice. He was with a Tunisian regiment, you see.
Yeah.
And this regiment consisted largely of Muslims and had no pastoral care. There was no Muslim chaplain or anything.
I didn't know that. Right.
Yeah, this is very, very important because he describes very vividly how he brings these dying men, these wounded men from the front back to the back of the fighting lines to be, attended to. Or very often he assisted dying men, and he describes this, how he sees the immense suffering of people. But the extraordinary thing is he was so involved with all these very important battles in the trenches of, along the French-German border. He never had a single wound himself, so that the Muslim soldiers, they admired him so much, they felt something. They said he was a Sidi Marabout, which is a North African expression, a Sufi expression, for a man who is tied to God. Someone has described it being tied to a God like a camel is to the post, and God's blessing is on him and protects him. So never, ever anything happened to him ever. So, it's quite remarkable when you think of these hundreds of thousands of people who were shot and died in the trenches in the bloody war. And he was never even wounded. So this is extraordinary. The second extraordinary thing is he was involved, with the army moving forwards with different battles. And in all this kind of turmoil, he starts writing his essays. You think, is this actually humanly possible? You know, and he felt he had seen something. He was really very interested, in seers, in mystics. He also read the mystics during the war and before. And, he saw something, and he had a kind of affinity and empathy for people who saw something very, very deep, something spiritual in reality. So he starts writing essays because he felt he might die any moment. This is in 1914, at the beginning of the war. He might die any moment, so he might as well write his intellectual testament and describe what he has seen, his inward vision. And the inward vision, the first very first essay I ever wrote was called Cosmic Life.
Right, I have that in front of me. Yeah. So these essays were collected in a book called, which is the title, Writings in Time of War.
But only after his death. He was never allowed, except for one essay, he was never allowed to publish any of those essays.
Right.
So these essays, they're really, if you like, the foundation. And all his later ideas, they already have the seeds in those essays.
I think, you know, I'd like to read just from the introduction in that first essay, Cosmic Life. What follows springs from an exuberance of life and a yearning to live. And again, it's so important to remember he is carrying mortally wounded bodies all day. He's as close to death as he can be. So what follows springs from an exuberance of life and a yearning to live. It is written to express an impassioned vision of the earth and in an attempt to find a solution for the doubts that beset my action. Because I love the universe, its energies, its secrets, and its hopes. And because at the same time I am dedicated to God, the only origin, the only issue, and the only term.
Yes.
You know,
That last text is not very well translated. Issue and term, it's the final, the goal, the ultimate summit, if you like. You know, in English, it sounds much weaker than in the French.
Interesting. And there's also a sentence just a couple sentences later that feels like this is how he starts pulling all of this together, right? His vision as a paleontologist, as a spiritual man, as somebody who's in the midst of war. My starting point is the fundamental initial fact that each one of us is perforce linked by all the material, organic, and psychic strands of his being to all that surrounds him. And, you know, what strikes me about that is it sounds like something that someone would write in the 21st century, but not in 1914.
Yeah, that's a very, very perceptive observation. You see, I find people write something today and I think, my goodness, I wrote this in Tejar in the 20s and 30s.
Right.
You know? And this is where he was also, why he was such a lonely man, why he had a vision that really was so comprehensive and so alive and so forward going, you know, that it was very unusual in his time. You know, I mean, very, very unusual. And this is, he tries to grasp what he's actually feeling and think, you know, he says sometimes I would love to be a musician, maybe to create a symphony or something to express the whole music of the universe. I would rather be a Wagner than a Darwin, you know, kind of interesting remark. But it's this power, this coercion almost, if you like, this inner this inner drunk in German, this inner push,
drive,
to go forward, to go forward. And you see, this goes on until he dies at the age of 74. I could give you passages from the last year or so where he moves actually from geology, from the rocks, you know, he moves more and more to biology, he moves to the future, he moves to the development of humanity.
Right.
Where are we going?
Yes. And so we're going to go there at least a little bit. I do, I think something that I hadn't realized until I got into Teilhard was that he was an exact contemporary of Einstein. They died in the same year in 1955.
Right.
That he was a paleontologist. He was off in China. He was helping authenticate the remains of the Peking Man fossil. His science didn't directly overlap, but he was also there as the theory of relativity was born, as quantum mechanics were born.
Yeah.
So there was this whole new view of space, time, and the universe that was unfolding on many spheres. But, you know, what I'm aware of is that I think even now, 100 years on from some of that, those of us who are not scientists have scarcely taken in, you know, how that new understanding of the universe, you know, actually changed our whole imagination about space and time. But Teilhard did know that, and it's so clear to me that all of that is there, and yet he's taking it to a different place as a theological and spiritual thinker, right? This idea of this cosmic vision, I mean, even the word cosmic, which took on a whole new meaning through science in the 20th century. I mean, when you think about how he used that term, you know, what did he mean when he talked about?
Early on, very early on, he was also a promoter of the notion of the biosphere. The biosphere, that word, was only created in 1874.
And who created that word? It was somebody else, right?
It's Suess. It's a Swiss paleontologist, Swiss geographer who created this word. And he wrote four volumes, which are translated as The Face of the Earth. And Teilhard uses that title for an essay in 1922. He wrote a sort of review about this because he's suddenly aware that we are not just living in one place, in one country, but it's, as you have just said, space and time. We're living on a globe. We're living on the whole Earth, and the Earth has a face and a kind of identity, almost a physiognomy like a person. It's like a cosmic person. And right. For him, religiously speaking, he sees this cosmic person as the body of Christ. I mean, he sees it really in his own Christian...
Right, and he even used the term cosmic Christ.
Yeah, he uses cosmic Christ. He speaks about the cosmic... And he sees us, you see, he speaks about we are but an atom in the universe. We are, and let us all be an atom in the body of Christ, he writes. You see, he's looking always for something very, very comprehensive, all-embracing, all interconnected. So it's really fascinating to see this. And he had this idea about, you know, about the oneness of humanity and the globe in the trenches, on the night watch, when he was observing in the dark the rising moon, the full moon, and he writes, it's extraordinary, he writes as if he had seen this very famous iconic photograph that the astronauts took 50 years or 40 years later, the planet, the planet as one planet in blue space, you know, just in this vast space. And he writes and says, well, what is this? How should we describe this? I mean, he doesn't even ask these questions. He's groping for words. So first he says, are we alone in the universe? Are we, you know, is there no way out? Are we imprisoned in the universe? What is it? Should we call this the sphere of the human, or what should we call it, a monad? And then after the war, when he had regular discussions with a philosopher friend, quite a famous philosopher, Edouard Leroy, they met and they discussed all these ideas, and they came up together with this notion of the noosphere, which is a it's a further development. It's a flowering out and grows out of the biosphere.
And it's the N-O-O-S, which, and noos is the Greek term for mind, right?
Right.
So the way I understand it, the biosphere is the earth of the layer of living things, and the noosphere is really about the layer of thinking beings and in fact of consciousness, right, which is
more. You see, sometimes people call it the sphere of the mind, but in my view that's mistaken let's say it's misleading, because nous, the Greek term of nous, is not our reason. It is the all-embracing inner vision of really deeply understanding something, having the vision that takes everything into account, which is not partial and separate and cuts things up. It's not about analysis, it's about synthesis, you see.
Okay.
And he has the sphere of the noosphere, I call it, it's the sphere of thinking, yes, but it's also the thinking that connects us. It's a sphere of action. It's a sphere of the specifically human, which he feels is still emerging. We are not how should I say, the human is not fully developed yet.
Right. So I want to stop there, and because it's evolutionary is how he thinks about it. And that's the other huge sphere of science that the theory of evolution.
Yeah.
That the world is still wrestling with in his lifetime and in some ways in ours.
Today, yes.
Right. And that he, as a Jesuit, of course, this is an intimate struggle that he has all of his career. He sees evolution as, I mean, there's this phrase, the holiness of evolution.
Yes.
God is at work within life.
Yes.
And not just that. I mean, as we said, he is working on the fossils of what we call the Peking Man in China. He's dealing with what he absolutely understands to be the pre I don't know what was it?
Pre-human development
forms. which is the most material manifestation of Darwin's theory of evolution. But then, as you just pointed at, he absolutely sees evolution, but he sees evolution happening both on a physical and a
spiritual
level. What does he say?
Level.
Yes, that evolution proceeds towards spirit.
Right.
And in some ways you have a sense that even as he looks at Peking Man and he sees himself as a 20th century human looking back at this primitive creature, that he also feels like humanity is still evolving spiritually,
yeah,
as well as physically. And he imagines that thousands and thousands of years in the future, you kind of think he thinks in terms of that kind of evolutionary time, which is very slow and hard to decipher at the moment, but that he imagines future man looking back and seeing a primitive spirituality, but he imagines this flowering of consciousness as you just described, this evolutionary consciousness.
It's mind-blowing, mind-boggling when you know, I mean, really, the whole region of cyberspace, you see, there are some people who say Teilhard is the patron saint of the World Wide Web. He's foreseen this.
Yes.
He has somehow, you know, had this idea that we will intensify our communication, but what are we doing? What do we do with it? That is really the big question and the big choice and option, because it's not happening automatically. It's not something that will necessarily finish in a good way. We have to really create it. And that he was very, very aware of our responsibilities and of our dangers and of our our tendency that things go wrong, sometimes terribly wrong. But he felt that in the end, everything will come together for the good, you know. And that is really, I would think, that is rooted in his deep Christian faith, that he really feels there is hope, we are going forward, we are creating a future, we must. He said at the end of his life, he wrote to his cousin in the letters from a traveler, he writes that he's less and less interested in geology, but more and more in the human and the ultra-human, the further development, if you like, of the human species. Where are we going as a species?
Right.
You know, and that is the spiritual kind of calling, if you like, the need to really rise higher, to go further, to develop more in human terms.
Right. I wish we could find there's a passage this is a little bit of an aside, but it came to me while I was preparing. I had this conversation recently. Someone came up to me and just said they'd become fascinated to think about how the internet and all of this technology that is taking us to, you know, some, is taking us somewhere.
Yeah,
whether
somewhere.
we can, you know, it is transcendent in its way. That they were so fascinated that all of it still comes from the earth, right? That it's all made. iPads and iPhones are made of rocks and metal.
Yeah.
And then that came back to me as I was preparing for this interview with you.
Yes, that's interesting.
But that's also actually our awareness of that is one of the places where we're having to stop and think ethically, right?
Yes.
About this technology.
Yes.
The evolutionary nature, and it seems to me, he was pushing also, he absolutely embraced Darwin's science, but, the struggle that Darwin saw, and I think maybe the pessimism that he experienced in some of the way people applied the idea of evolution to thinking about human nature and nature. He talked about the problem of action. And it seems to me that, you know, there's this language that's so interesting all the way through his theology and his writing about zest for living ardor and vigor and vitality. And that he really saw, the point of the greater consciousness was greater action. And it seems to me that he was very focused. And I'd like for you to explain, you know, how, you know, because I think this is very unusual. I don't even think you see theologians writing about this, or even social activists writing so much about this, that to do the important work is hard, that it's hard to find the energy for that, and that is the great challenge, not just to be conscious and to know what we need to do, but to constantly summon that zest for living, that ardor, that takes us beyond where we even know we can go.
That's very well put, because he's very, very interested in the sources and resources of human energy. He says in the same letter that I quoted from earlier that he is interested in the human development and the ultra-human, that it's about human energetics. He spoke about human
energetics. He coined a lot of words, didn't he? He found language to be restrictive, and he was always making up words.
And that makes it so difficult to read him, because once the terminology was there, he further developed it and he changed it. And it's very difficult. And then the way he wrote his essays and the way they were published, it's very difficult to study him in depth. You have to do a lot of detective work, how he used his ideas and when did they first appear. But this zest for life, you see, he has got, from very early on, he speaks about, you know, the stream of becoming and the power of life, and how everything is living around us, and how alive, and he says to his friends, trust life, go ahead, push forward, don't go on a retreat, push forward. I've just discovered this. I've read a recent correspondence that was only published last year between him and one of his closest friends, who was also interested in paleontology. This was a French count called Max Beguin, and his wife Simone, who first also started publishing Teilhard's essays secretly and giving them to friends. Now, this man, Max Beguin, he went to Morocco in the 30s to develop a big factory among Moroccans to develop, to collect roses for rose essence for the perfume industry. And he wanted to do this. He said, this may sound very odd, but he wanted to do this for as a kind of cooperative with the indigenous people. And he ran into a lot of trouble among the colonialists. The French colonialists didn't want that. They wanted to be in charge and give the orders all from above. And Max tried to apply Teilhard's ideas. And what is so interesting in this correspondence, which is not just Teilhard's letters, but also some of the letters from Max, you see how someone who works very practically in industry and economics and business tries to apply Teilhard's visionary ideas and Teilhard's transformative ideas and his zest for life in very, very difficult and unusual situations. And that's very concrete, you know. And,
right.
And he's in touch with them until the end of his life. So he was in touch with them for over 30 years. He met this man in the trenches in 1915, and he corresponds with him till 1955. So you have a very good documentation there how someone applies Teilhard's forward thinking and positive thinking and this zest for life even when the going gets very hard. And I use this myself in my own life, his way of really approaching this, because it's so empowering. It's because it's always trying not to give up, but to see something positive, even when things go very badly. You know, in Teilhard, the first visit to China, for example, in 1923, he wrote afterwards reflections. He said, well, you know, it didn't really turn out the way he had expected it. And he said, well, what have I actually gained from this? You know, have I gained anything? And this is always something you can ask. Even when, you know, Van Jan is ill or has an accident or things don't work out or relationships don't work out, can I really distill something positive that still gives me energy rather than destroys me and puts me down? And I've used this with students. You may find this very interesting. I've read some of these passages with first-year students who had never even heard Teilhard's name. And some of them, I found this so empowering. And at the end, I asked them always, write me a few sentences. What has Teja meant to you, or how do you see his thinking? And I've had most amazing testimonies from students. And one girl who had been also an artist, she wrote, she said, you know, she said, this has helped me more to get over depression than all the medicines that the doctor gave me last year. And I found this really quite a powerful testimony.
Do you have some words of this correspondent of him? Do you have any of those writings in front of you? Or maybe you could send us something after the interview.
I mentioned it to Trellis when we talked on the when we spoke on the phone. This correspondence is only in French. It's not being translated.
Oh,
but
okay.
I could send you some sentences.
Yes, yes.
It is really quite powerful because, you know, can you just imagine, Teja wrote at the beginning, just before the Second World War, he wrote an essay, Let's Save Mankind. Sauvons l'humanité in French. Let us save humanity, you know. And Simone, Max's wife, who used to type encyclostyle these essays, they produced 10,000 copies of this to distribute among their friends. Can you imagine 10,000 copies in 1939?
I mean,
it's really to influence people to try and be positive rather than negative, and to help moving forward rather than trying to just be passive. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
For me, these energy resources, that's a very, very important theme. I've written quite a bit about this because what Teja also connects this to, and I think I should mention this here, is what are the energy resources, what are the spiritual energy resources we have in the human community? And he says in several essays, he says the following. We have thousands of engineers and scientists who calculate all the time how many energy resources we have left in terms of coal and uranium and metals so on. But he said, where are the technicians of the spirit? Where are the spiritual energy resources that we need for our own self-development? And he says, there we have to also look at the resources of wisdom we have in the global community, the resources of faith of the different religions. And he was a pioneer of early interfaith dialogue. He felt we have to communicate to each other the best that we possess in our traditions rather than the worst, and help to work together to stimulate human energy and spiritual development.
It's so interesting how he takes something that we talk about a lot, but he's coming at it from such a different angle that it opens it up.
Right.
I mean, here's some lines from an essay he wrote about zest for living.
Yeah.
By zest for living or zest for life, I mean here, to put it very approximately, that spiritual disposition at once intellectual and effective, in virtue of which life, the world, and action seem to us, on the whole, luminous, interesting, appetizing.
Right.
And then he says it is something utterly and entirely different from a mere emotional state.
This is, you know, it's very powerful. And in French, you see, the French expression is le goût de vivre. It's not just the zest, it's the taste. You have to have almost a taste, like for music or for art.
Right.
Or
so
for
it's sensory as well.
You know, it is sensory, you almost feel it at your fingertips. You know, what is this? What makes you, I mean, I sometimes say, what makes you tick? What makes people get out of bed in the morning and get them to go? You know, how do you get going when you're tired going up a mountainside, or when the weather is bad, or when someone is dying, or this? You see, he wrote two essays on the energy of suffering. Now, that is an unusual way of looking. And that was because he had a sister who was permanently disabled. She had, I've forgotten what she had, what illness she had, but she was in bed for 20 or 30 years, and then she died. And she had a kind of, she had created a fellowship of people who were permanently disabled, and she produced a book in about, or someone produced a book in 1950, and Teja wrote a foreword for this on the value and the energy of suffering, how this can be transformed into a source of energy also, which is an unusual way of thinking. Very unusual way of thinking.
Well, and I think it's important to come back to the fact that he didn't articulate lovely phrases like zest for living out of a life that felt like it was charmed at every stage.
No,
I mean,
no.
Right? His life had a lot of struggle in it. I mean, he did have I think a pretty solid childhood, but as a Jesuit, these two passions of his were constantly called into question. As we've said, he was writing all his life, and he was very poetic. He wasn't just a thinker. He really was a writer, and none of this could be published. He would send things to Rome for approval, which never came. As you say, I mean, his science, when you look back on it, there were these many accomplishments and high points, but that was long years spent laboring. And so he talks about struggle, and then, of course, there's the experience of the war, not as an abstraction.
No.
As something that he was always struggling even as he was articulating these ideas.
That is very true. And also in China, he saw, on his many expeditions across China, I mean, don't forget, he created the basis for the geology teaching on China. I mean, he began that. And he became very, very respected by the Chinese and became part of the Chinese Geological Survey in 1930-31. That is how they invited him to look at Peking Man and so on. But he really felt that you have to be involved in so many different ways. He had a richness and diversity of life that very few people had. And he traveled with other scientists, whether Chinese or Western. He traveled across the lengths and breadths of China. Mm-hmm. And he saw, particularly in the 1930s, all these warlords fighting. I mean, during the famous Yellow Expedition that he made with a team of Renault specialists who tried out new caterpillar cars to go across the desert. They were captured. I mean, instead of going for a few months, he was away almost a year, and it affected his health in heat, in terrible cold. They had to live in tents. They couldn't communicate with the outside world, and they were held captive, and it was a terrible experience. But he saw how the peasants, how poor, impoverished people lived on the soil. And there are testimonies by Chinese workers who have experienced him, or people who were wounded, who he bandaged, and so on. I mean, there are many, many aspects of Teya which are not necessarily immediately visible when you open his writings. People have really... I've heard Chinese... In 1981, UNESCO celebrated centenary of Teya's birth through a symposium in Paris. And I went to that, and present at it was an eminent Chinese paleontologist who had been trained by Teya and who gave us quite a testimony about his, what you really felt was the power of presence of this man and his utter modesty and, his ability.
His smile. I noticed that people also mention his smile.
Yes.
His demeanor.
Yes.
Was magnetic.
And also people said he could relate to an ordinary worker or to a housewife or to a highest intellectual or a scientist. He was at home anywhere and everywhere in a way, which is it's not everybody who can do that.
And so I want to kind of dig a little bit more deeply into some of the particularities of his thought that also people now listening might learn from. But one thing I do think in this context it's good to mention is, again, he integrated all of this into his theology and into his vision of spiritual evolution. One thing that's very striking is this mass on the world that he said in China.
Oh, yes.
Right. So here you kind of have how he captured much of this in his religious sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
Since I have neither bread nor wine nor altar, I will raise myself beyond these symbols up to the pure majesty of the real itself.
Mm-hmm.
I, your priest, will make the whole earth my altar, and on it I will offer you all the labors and sufferings of the world.
It's a wonderful passage. And that was, he talks about getting, coming out of his tent, seeing the rising sun, the dawn, and in the desert, it must have been magnificent spectacle, you know, very, a great silence, and then this wonderful natural phenomena. You know, he was really so taken up by this and deeply, deeply moved. And then he could, of course, in his scientific training, he could relate it to both the evolutionary development of the earth and of life, but also spiritually he saw it as the communication or the being at work of divine energies, spiritual energies that penetrate us all and that we can connect with and be empowered by. I mean, this is where he talked, this divine milieu. He speaks in the Mass on the World about the divine milieu. That is also a concept or an idea and experience that comes from the First World War onwards.
How would you describe that, the divine milieu, what he meant when he used that term?
You know, for me, it's the milieu in the French sense is the center, but we also use milieu in terms of the environment. It's both the center, something comes together like in a diamond, you know, just something captured in one center, but then it radiates throughout the entire Teilhard used a lot the image of the circle and the image of the sphere, like the sphere of the globe, the atmosphere, the lithosphere, the biosphere, the noosphere. You see, he sees everything three-dimensionally or even, you know, beyond in four-dimensional space-time dimensions because of his scientific training. But this divine milieu is, I see the divine milieu as a spiritual expression of what, more secularly speaking, he calls the noosphere. You know, the noosphere is, on one hand, the human side, which connects to the divine milieu as the spiritual energy center and powerhouse, if you like. You know, the divine is, it's the presence of the divine. It's God is everywhere, in a sense, you know, hidden, not visible, but somehow reachable. And he talks about, you know, I when I think about it, God is at the end of my pen, is here, but I can connect with something which is an energy that opens me up into higher and higher worlds. You see,
again, that energy illusion. Was it also in the context of the divine milieu that he used? He spoke of the human as matter at its most incendiary stage.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're right. That's a wonderful...
Which is also such a wonderful image.
It's a wonderful phrase, really. So, you see, I think he has this dynamic, transformative awareness from his evolutionary approach. So one could call his spirituality also an evolutionary spirituality, as some people do. Mm-hmm. But he sees... in everything that develops from the big, I mean, at his time, people didn't speak about the Big Bang, but we would today, you know, that there is a centration of matter, and this centration arises or develops through complexification. It's the complexity building up, you know, and he does this in his book, The Human Phenomenon, from the simplest, you know, the molecules, the atoms, the molecules, the cells, you know, into forms of life, into human forms, and into communities. It's a process that is ongoing, but it is complexification in a way. And I mean, today, this is very important in complexity theory in biology, but he sees that in the evolutionary pattern, everything develops in terms of divergence. There is greater and greater profusion of diversity. And that's also true among the human species, you know, all the different people. It's more and more diverse, but he sees the opposite movement at play also. The divergence ultimately comes together in there is a convergent movement by people coming together, by forms coming together, by complexifying. And out of this movement emerges something new, always something, the next step, taking up what was there before, but emerging into something new. And he feels that we are today at a very, very important threshold of emerging into a new phase of humanization, or what he calls hominization, of becoming human in a different way from the way our forebears were.
Right, right.
Do you see, it's this immense, and he has this absolute, how should I say, this, what is it, a kind of call, a kind of movement towards the future. There is this pull from the future and towards the future. And he is less and less interested in the past and more interested in where are we going, what are we doing with the potential we have, with the resources we have, with the imagination, the creativity, the consciousness, the complexification of people thinking together and acting together. What is all this aiming for? Do you see what I mean?
I do. And even as you say, he's less interested in the past. I think that his work as a paleontologist, his sense of time that he had from that, of the time that change takes, which he measured, you know, which would be measured in thousands and millions of years rather than decades, also maybe helped keep his own. I mean, he helped keep that keep that vision vital, vigorous, and hopeful, because he didn't just see things in terms of what happened yesterday or tomorrow or was possible 10 years from now.
No, that's very true. And he's, you know, he has a really what some people call a metaphysics of the future. And he said when he came back from the Yellow Expedition, from some of these expeditions, I'm a pilgrim. I have come from the past, but I'm a pilgrim of the future. I'm going forward. And it's about going forward, not hanging, not dwelling on what we achieved in the past and how far we got or what we lost. No, it's what we are, you know, not only what we are now, but what we can be, to be more. That is was for him always, you know, we can be more, we can do more, we can be more fulsome, we can be more perfect, if you like, we can be more spiritual, we can be more loving. I mean, we haven't said anything about the energies of love yet, which is really the central insight for him, you know, because at one level, he speaks very early on in the 20s of the law of complexity consciousness. Now, this sounds very abstract, but what he means by this, when material arrangements become more and more complex. The more complex they get, the more they become centered. You know, and you can see this in the build-up, let's say, from the atoms to the molecules to the cells. They become more and more centered, and the more centered it becomes, the more it becomes, if you like, psychic and conscious, and at the human level, self-conscious. Do you see? So that's what he calls the law of complexity consciousness, which is an ongoing pattern running through evolution and running through the human community. So he feels that if we organize our communities, our societies in a more loving, in a more constructive way, we also become more conscious, we are more self-conscious, we can become more spiritual. You see, that's the way he sees it.
And I do want to talk about love as an energy. So again, to kind of bring this back to a more practical level, you talked, you know, again, all this time that he's having these large ideas, he is so his sense of the struggle that's always involved in that is important. His sense that the point of greater consciousness is action, to make these things, make this change occur. And you mentioned a minute ago that he said we have to draw on all the resources we have for energy, for spiritual energy. So talk about love also as one of those.
Love, for him, that's really, really very central. You see, he sees this coming together, uniting, you know, even at the level of the molecule and the cell, he sees this as a kind of rudimentary structure of coming together. And he feels that love is a cosmic force. It brings the universe into being, and it brings all the different things into existence. And at the human level, it has a very specific spiritual, material, bodily, cosmic form. All these different aspects come together.
Yes, but, I mean, it's cosmic and in the most personal experience at once.
Right. And he feels that the power of love is the power that humans have to transform the world and themselves and their communities. And he writes about love as a spiritual energy force that is unexplored, that we haven't studied enough, that we haven't learned to teach and apply and practice enough. And what is for me quite extraordinary is that Teilhard writes about the energies of love and the positive transformation that love can or could work in the human community. He speaks about, this sounds again quite abstract, but he uses the Latin word amor for love, amorization. We need more amorization in the human community. We need to free those energies and make, not love as a sentimental feeling, but love as a transformative, deep spiritual power. He wrote a famous an essay which finishes in 1934, and it finishes with the words, "The day will come when after harnessing the powers of matter and of space and of the winds and all the different kind of physical and material powers, we will harness for God the powers of love, and then humanity will have discovered fire for a second time." That's a very mysterious, famous quotation. Right. And an American musician and manager, a woman who has got lots of different, different competence. She has written a whole book about this, a woman called Anne Hillman, Awakening the Energies of Love, and how this is part of the whole process of the maturation of humanity. Now, the extraordinary thing for me is that the very words that Teilhard uses when he writes about love are paralleled completely and utterly independently in the works of the Russian-American sociologist Pitrim Sorokin, who is the founding father of sociology at Harvard University, and who died later than Teilhard, but who has written, in 1954, he wrote a book, The Ways and Power of Love, which was reprinted in 2002 by the Templeton Foundation. It is about the transformative power of love, where Sorokin, as a sociologist, looks at societies in the past, and he says, like Teilhard, we have not sufficiently explored the energies of love. We know a lot about all the other energies, but what could love do to heal the world, to help us when people have mental illness, to help us to overcome war and violence? I mean, Sorokin belief that it could be done, but that we have to work at it very, very hard.
And which that's Teilhard also believed.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's independent. It's kind of like.
So they didn't. You don't have any sense that they knew each other or knew of each other's
nothing.
Work.
I have written a long article about this and published it. Mm. There is no contact between them whatsoever. It's totally independent, but it's like a sort of zeitgeist. You know, two people having very similar ideas, which happens in other cases.
So I want to ask you just about a couple of other details of his thinking, and then let's talk about how his ideas resonate now. The idea of seeing, and the difference between seeing and knowing. Mm-hmm. Is that important? Is that a tool also for people to get inside this thinking?
Yes, I think so. That would need quite a bit further exploration.
All right. Well, then
I think I can say as much that, knowing, it depends what you mean by knowing. Seeing is another way, but a non-intellectual way of knowing, and I think knowing and seeing combine, knowing in terms of understanding, a deeper understanding, it's really coming out of the guts and out of the heart, and really how we can actually be really certain or sure about this. Like a person who has a very deep faith, whether it's a Buddhist or Jew or Hindu or Muslim or Christian, it doesn't matter, that you really feel you know something in your life that matters to you very deeply, or in human relationships where you have basic fundamental trust. I think that is so, so deep in us. And that is this or this original trust, which is so much part of life, you know, that every child is born with and that we often destroy through education or bad treatment and so on. I feel really that this seeing, this inner seeing, is, it's of course connected with our faculties of imagination, of creativity, but also of sensibility, how far mm-hmm. we have trained our senses to be observant, to listen attentively to when someone speaks to us, to be reflective in terms of what we respond, or to really, you know, see the needs of people, or see the joy of people when they're really happy, or when they're fulfilled, right, or when they have, you know, achieved something for which they had to work very hard or strive. I mean, there are all these different dimensions. So I feel seeing is a much deeper spiritual experience and facility that people can have.
Right, but, and very accessible.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. I think you need a training for this. Okay. It's not something, you know, like, you know, we can all sing, but we don't all become singers or dancers or whatever, but we can move our body, we can right. use our senses, and in the same way we have to use our mind, but we have, of course, different intellectual and personal capacities and abilities. But I do think we need guidance, or we need an appeal to our imagination and to develop these faculties. I speak, this is not a word by Teya. Working on Teya has given me the idea of really introducing another word, which is called pneumatophore, that comes from biology, and it means carrier of spirit, and it is a biological, it's from biological taxonomy. It means the air roots of plants in mangroves, you know, and the biologists call them carriers of air, really, because the air roots take the air from through these, you know, from the air they take, the plants take their nourishment. And I say we need spiritual pneumatophores, we need ideas and people to develop this capacity that we all have, but that often is atrophied in terms of spiritual sensitivity and development.
Right. And we need teachers, right? And
yes.
we have always needed teachers. And I mean, I think that's that's an interesting way to talk about how in our time many people have rediscovered Teilhard.
Yes.
And I wonder, how long have you been working with him? And
well, it's 19. I started in 1963, so that's 50 years almost.
Right. So I'd be curious, over these 50 years, how have you experienced it? Have you experienced an evolution of a discovery of him? And also, has there been a change in what people are drawn to, what they're paying attention to?
I can say yes to both questions. I mean, when his works were first published, which was mainly in the late 1950s, 1960s, up to the mid-1970s, young people and many, many, I mean, his works were bestsellers at the time, and there was a lot of interest in him. But then later on, it became really less so, because people moved on and they thought, oh, this is rather, you know, passé, and maybe other people have gone further. And there was less of interest. For example, in England, none of his works are in print. And his works, you see, are also not, they're not edited and published in the best way for people to gain easy access.
Right. You really noticed that, too. I really noticed the difference in translations, because we got some of these books from the library and they were older translations.
Yeah. And that makes a big difference, you see. And you really have to understand what, you can't just do a textual translation word by word. You have to really understand what he's saying and how it relates to other things and how these works were created. So you need also a whole, you know, you need to know what is called a whole hermeneutic, a whole style of interpreting him, to know how the words are contextualized and where they were created and how they, I feel really that there is a very close integration of his life and work, and that his life and vision are really all of they're united, they're one. And you can't really look at his works without looking at his life and his
experiences. Right, so just as spiritual writings, separate from that.
Yeah,
from
he writes not at an academic, academician or abstractly in his armchair. He writes from his experience in the field as a geologist, as a pastor, in the war. I mean, he writes from an inner necessity and in a way he wants to communicate a message and a vision that he has. This is why I call him a spirit of fire. You know, the life and vision, it's really animated. It is fired. It is driven, if you like. It is called. It is brought alive by the coming together of so many different things. But you see, I have found you need an explanation. You need people to explain this to understand Teilhard and to have an access to Teilhard. I think there is, especially in the United States, there is now a coming back and a new interest. And it's interesting that several scientists have pointed out that, you know, because Teilhard's books, when they were published, became such bestsellers, people have concentrated on his spiritual message and they have almost forgotten that
his
he was
science.
See, for example, David Sloan Wilson, who is quite a well-known evolution biologist in the States, he's written in his latest book, "It is wrong for Teilhard to be read only for his spiritual message. Let his scientific flame burn brightly again." You see?
Oh, that's interesting, because he's also not a religious thinker, is
he,
David Sloan Wilson?
No, he isn't, but he's written in his latest book, which is called, I've got the reference here. What is it called? It's called The Neighborhood Project, Using Evolution to Improve My City One Block at a Time.
He's written about Teilhard in that book.
He has chapter 5 is
that
called
is
Enter the Noosphere. Enter the Noosphere. And he's absolutely bowled over by it.
Okay.
And he says that he was invited to a theology science conference at the Vatican a couple of years ago or whatever, and he felt then obliged that he had to really read something on Teilhard, and he wrote The Human Phenomenon, which he had never read, and he was absolutely bowled over. And he says actually that Teilhard is still, that he is still very, very much in the, you know, in the interest of our age, that he was in advance at his time, and he's still in advance of some scientists today, which I found an interesting statement.
Really interesting. What I've noticed in recent years is that many environmentalists or some of these there are some really interesting dialogues between theologians and scientists and environmental activists, and that Teilhard comes up in that context. Now, it seems to me that in his lifetime, I mean, he was also there as industrialization was taking off.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that I don't see him being all that attentive to that or concerned about it in the way of environmental activism that we think now. In contrast to somebody like Einstein, you know, who was very concerned about physicists and chemists becoming purveyors of weapons. But so how do you how do you react to that way that Teilhard is being taken up? How do you see that?
You mean that he's perhaps not sufficiently environmentally aware? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, I think I'm not sure that he was personally. That does not mean that his thinking isn't absolutely applicable to to current concerns.
It is. I mean, there's a whole book on Teilhard and people on the planet, and I've written on his ecological understanding, because there are many passages which are much more modern than you might think.
Okay.
But you see, I think he was probably not always sufficiently aware of the dangers of science. I think that's a criticism one can make, that he was too enthusiastic. But part of that may be due to the fact that he was really far away from European developments for 20 years.
Right,
I mean, he may just have been...
Cairo, he was in China.
Yeah, that he may have been too far out of the mainstream of these discussions, you see. But I think he had a sense for the environment, particularly because he was so concerned with planet Earth, you see. And I think one can see in many ways what Wilson says in his book, that he calls him a titan of reflection, an individual building upon the ideas of Darwin and hundreds of other thinkers that preceded him. And he says, and this is an interesting expression, he says Teilhard was more than an individual. He was a node in a vast system of cooperation, the cultural practices that we call science. His worldview is suffused with the immensity of time and space and embedded within the great arc of evolution. Wilson asks, why have professional evolutionists forgotten Teilhard as well as the humanistic side of Julian Huxley? That's by the way. He speaks of Teilhard's exceptional act of brilliance in viewing humans not merely as highly successful species, but in considering humanity as a new evolutionary process capable of generating a diversity of cultural forms, just as life is capable of generating a diversity of organic forms.
This
makes the origin of our species in some ways as momentous as the origin of life itself. I find that a very, very thought-provoking passage.
Yes. It's a fascinating example of Teilhard being taken up in the present. You said a little while ago that he was that he was ahead of his time in terms of interfaith or interreligious matters. Now, he was deeply, profoundly Christian, right? I mean, he talked about Jesus as the mover and driver of evolution, of the cosmic Christ. There's no doubt about that, so he was Christocentric, as the theologians would say.
Yes.
But I did want to ask you, and I certainly want to ask you, since you made that comment, you know, how he would think about the plurality of faith in the world now, and how you think that is reflected in his vision of spiritual evolution.
Well, that's a good question. I've written a whole book about that.
Yeah.
In terms of particularly Teilhard de Chardin and Eastern religions, you see, when he first went to China in 1923, that's almost a century ago, he was looking, and I could quote you many passages, he was looking for a renewal of Western Christianity through Buddhism. And he couldn't find it because the kind of Buddhism he found, you know, he went to the wrong places, if you like, you know, the deserts and the kind of high mountains of China is not exactly the place where you find living Buddhism at its most vibrant. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
But he was very interested when he came back, whilst he was in China, but also when he came back to Paris in 1946 after the war, he made a special effort to learn more about different religions, and he went to the Museum of Orient of Eastern Art, Musée Guimet in Paris, borrowed books, read on Hinduism particularly, and he wanted to find out how far these different religions, particularly Eastern religions, could relate to what we are doing in the West. So this was something that many people were interested in, and he joined a small group that was a French branch of the World Congress of Faith, which was founded in 1936 in Britain, and which was founded in the French branch was founded after the war in Paris. And Teilhard was in fact invited to give the keynote lecture for the opening of this, and he was not allowed to appear in public and speak about these matters. So he wrote a piece which someone else had to read out. You see, and it starts. What is the piece about? It's about faith in man, the human developing, starting with what he calls with an ecumenism at the basis. We have to come together and work together to build up the world, and then we can also reach the spirit together or come closer in our spiritual understanding. I mean, that was his view, was that really that the different religions are like big currents or rivers that flow in different directions, but somehow they can also come together now because humanity is coming together. So he was really looking for a greater unity.
I love this image you noted a moment ago about divergence and convergence.
Yeah.
And it's not an either or, it's both at the same time.
Right.
And in fact, it's the two together that give each their vitality. You know, I imagine that, you know, that his idea of convergence would not be a simple harmonizing, but that the divergence, in fact, is the vitality of these traditions.
It's complexity. Complexity.
So he would not be doing away with that, and I don't even imagine that he would be at all minimizing his language about his very Christian understanding and language.
No, he might. I mean, theologically, he might engage with contemporary theological ideas and modify some of his expressions, I would imagine. But mm-hmm. I think basically he felt really that most of the edifice of doctrines and rituals and all the different cultural forms that have been built up in each religious tradition, in a way, you know, they're only helpful if they help us to build the future. You know, mm-hmm. and many, he often used to say that the religions really are fossilized. They still live in the Neolithic age.
And interesting for him to use language like
Neolithic
that, the paleontologist.
Neolithic age. And he's really less interested in all these details. And he speaks about the dreary piety of chapels and churches. He doesn't want any of this. He's more at home in nature, in the universe.
And I think in the mystical tradition, both of Catholicism and I'm sure the other mystical traditions.
That's true. And he feels really we should concentrate on the essentials and that which deepens our life and our being and our vision and our possibility of greater collaboration, of coming to. He was interested in the process of unification wherever it was possible, in the human species, among members of different faiths, among members of different races. He wanted to bring people together and be united through a very deep spiritual bond. And this is the power of love also. I mean, what the power of love, what I haven't mentioned, and it's probably late to start with this now, is the, is the power of the feminine. I mean, he was also very, very interested. He talked about the feminine as being the power of the unitive, of bringing people together.
It's very unusual that a man of his generation, I think, spoke in that way.
Yeah, that's true. But he had many very extraordinary women friends, artists and intellectuals and so on. And he felt really without, he says, nothing in my life has happened without the influence of some feminine look or participation or whatever.
Right, and we don't have time to go into this, but there is, of course, the interesting relationship he had with Lucille Swann, and you've written a book about the correspondence between the two of them. It was a woman who it was a passionate relationship, and she would very much have liked for it to be more, and you sense that the passion was equally profound on his end, but he took his vows as a Jesuit seriously, and yet there was a great richness and depth to that their love for each other.
It's a wonderful correspondence, but you have the power of his faithfulness to his vision. He felt that people could not believe in the truths of his vision if he abandoned his own way of living. You see, his order was his family. The Jesuits were really his brethren, and he was at home with them.
Yes. So in the last few minutes we have, I wonder if you just reflect with me on how your long communion with Teilhard's life and writings, you know, has shaped your sense of God and reality and what it means to be human.
That's a very big question.
I know. You have 10 minutes.
Very quick. Well, I don't know. I could say a lot in 10 minutes, and I could say a lot that was tried. I don't want to do that. But he has deeply, deeply influenced me. He has empowered, encouraged, and inspired me. And what I feel really, I've not really talked about his mysticism. I've written a whole book, or I have more than one book on mysticism, how he was really, you know, his love for the spirit, for the divine, for God, how he was really carried and animated by him. And, you know, he uses these two symbols, these two metaphors of the heart and fire, they run through all his writings. And mm-hmm. that has very much inspired me. The fire, and that the fire of faith, of mystical experience, of union, and that comes together in the center, in the heart, you know. And he really had a very traditional worship to the heart of Christ, which is the sacred heart is a very traditional worship, but he understands something quite different by it. And he has a beautiful litany which was found on his desk when he died, where really he sees, you know, this at the heart of his faith, which he never gave up, even though he suffered a great deal. He was very tempted by other people and by the difficulties he had to change his way, but he was faithful to this vision, which begins, you know, in about 1910, 1911, and with which he died in 1955. So it's an extraordinary testimony of a human life, you know, of a great, great man, a great scientist, and a very deep believer.
And what is the litany? Do you have that?
I have a quote. Well, I don't know that I can find. I would have to send you this. I can find it from one of my texts. I haven't got it in my head.
Where is it?
It's in one of the books. It is reproduced, but I can't give you the.
Is it in your selected writings? At the end, is it?
No, it's not there.
No?
I'm not sure whether it's at the end of the Heart of Matter. I can't remember for this moment.
I don't have that one
quoted,
with me.
I've quoted it somewhere in. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, whether I've got it here. Wait a minute, whether I've got a paper.
I'd love to hear it in your words. In your voice.
Yeah, I haven't got this. Wait a minute, whether I find. It's about evolution and. Let me see the divine, as I find it. I'm not
sure. It's okay if you can't find it. But if you can't, then we'll have you send it to us. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, I can send you the text. Mm-hmm. I would have to reproduce it because that is really important. It gives a real kind of signature to his life. You know, like after Pascal's death. Pascal was from the great scientist and mystic of the earlier centuries in France, 16th century, I think it is, 16th, 17th. He had a litany written, which they found sewn into his jacket, whereas Teilhard had it on his desk. But it is a similarly powerful statement.
So Trent is telling me that they're probably going to get you back on the line before this project is over. So don't worry about it, but we may have you read it. We may set up another time to speak and have you read it then. I would love that.
Okay.
Well, I feel like we've covered a lot of territory, and I'm aware that we could keep speaking for hours, but is there anything that, you know, that I haven't mentioned that just feels really pressing and important to bring up still?
Well, I don't know that, you know, there's so much that I can't really say. We have a great work to do. He says this in the 1920s, and that was taken up by Thomas Barry, and that is being carried on by a whole group of people. You know, the way we have to learn to love, the way we have to evolve as a human species at a global level, the way that we have to come together in greater oneness, the way that we have to maintain and advance the zest for life in order to ensure human flourishing and the of all people of the planet and of the planet itself. This is very much linked to realizing our spiritual interdependence as much as our economic and biological interdependence. And I think the more people see this and become aware of that, the more they can take responsibility for collaborating with each other and helping each other.
Hmm. Well, I thank you so much, and I'm very excited. I hadn't read Teilhard for years until I got into this, and I'm just now so excited to do this. I think we will probably interview David Sloan Wilson. I'm delighted that you told me that, and I know you're in touch with Trent and that you're our advisor on the whole project. So if I don't speak with you again, I just know how thrilled I am that you're working with us and how I think this program will be, you know, very eye-opening for people. So thank you
so much. That's very kind. You know, I wanted to start with a story which I should perhaps finish
there's
a minute.
Sure.
And that's a story that is a wonderful story by Jean Houston, the president, former president of the American Association for Humanistic Psychology, she wrote a piece in her book, A Mythic Life, published in 1996, about meeting Teya. And she met him as old Mr. Teya in Central Park when she was a little girl of 13. And this was in the last year of Teya's life. And I can't read you out the story, but I have a very short version of it. But what is so wonderful is that he engaged with this little girl whilst walking through Central Park, and they walked regularly because she walked her dog once or twice a week, and she would meet him on his way to the Museum of Natural History where he worked. And what she brings across in this story is how this man had no self-consciousness at all. She didn't know who he was, but he would say, "Jean, feel yourself to be the caterpillar. Look at the metamorphosis of all this. Look at yourself. Feel the metamorphosis. And what will you become when you're a butterfly?" Or he would say, "Look at the clouds, God's calligraphy in the sky." Then he would say, "Jean, sniff the wind. Same wind sniffed by Jesus Christ. Same wind sniffed by Jeanne d'Arc, by Caesar. Feel the tides of history flowing through you." And then I would feel myself related to all time and history. You know, and she says he had no self-consciousness. He was larger than life. And she left all her littleness behind because she taught him that everything was related and that somehow he looked at you as if you were God in hiding, and you had to rise to that occasion and become that. Right. And I grew more and more that year than I ever did in any other time in my life. And she discovered many years later, when she found in the bookshop The Phenomenon of Man, as it was originally called in its first translation, with his photograph on the cover, that this was the man, Mr. Teya, she had met in Central Park when she was young. You know, it's an amazing story. And it's very moving how she describes how he really transmitted to her this love for everything around her and being whole and being connected with everything.
Oh, I love that story. Will you make sure that we know where to find that, too?
Yes, I can give you the reference.
Okay, because that's something we could put on the website.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and we'll continue this conversation.
Thank you very much indeed for your interview and for all your very interesting questions. Oh. I hope you enjoy reading Teyamo.
I do. I've enjoyed reading him and you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.